Recently, Biden said that they're not sending weapons to Israel anymore. Do you think they already had sent enough for the fight in Israel? That's why he's saying that, or they're changing their policy?
I mean, it's clearly linked to the fact that Biden told Israel not to go into Rafah and Israel went into Rafah. Does Israel have enough bombs to carry out the Rafah operation? Yes. The problem is Israel doesn't have enough bombs to have a sustained military engagement with Hezbollah. And they definitely don't have enough bombs to have a sustained military engagement with Hezbollah and Iran at the same time. By denying Israel these weapons, you create a strategic logistical problem for Israel that makes sustained high-end combat virtually impossible. How long the United States can do this, I don't know. We'll see how long they can do it. But this is a serious problem now for Israel. Now, I would hope that Biden would follow up with additional pressures of this sort. We'll see. Right now, frankly speaking, I don't think we're going to see a situation where the United States is going to allow Israel to run out of bombs. We know that even during this period of time where the supplemental funding had been frozen by Congress, the United States was still supplying ammunition to Israel. And so now that the supplemental has been unfrozen and the weapons that are supposed to go to Israel are paid for by the supplemental, I imagine that if push comes to shove, weapons will still flow into Israel. That this is more of a political gesture by Joe Biden than something real and meaningful. But it's a start. I mean, it's the first time we've done something like this in a long time. So I'd like to hope that we can double down on this and make it serious, because that's the only way to get the Israelis to wake up. They are totally dependent upon us for critical military equipment and aerial bombs and spare parts for their aircraft and things of that nature. That's America. They have a high tempo of operation right now. Maintenance demands are greater than ever. And one would imagine on some high-end aircraft like the F-35, that if the United States shut down the supply of spare parts, that F-35s can't fly anymore. And then Israel has a problem.
New polls show that 58% of Israelis are in favor of an immediate resignation of Netanyahu. In your opinion, whoever replaces Netanyahu would benefit the peace in Palestine, in Israel, or it's going to get worse? Are we going to get a more radical person getting into the power in Israel, or are we going to have somebody like Yitzhak Rabin, and who was in favor of peace mostly?
I don't think you can get a government that's more radical than the government that currently exists. And if you take Benjamin Netanyahu out of the equation, I don't think there's a personality with the history of engagement with right-wing Israeli political parties that could assemble and sustain the coalition that Netanyahu has built. So I think if Netanyahu goes away, this coalition collapses. But the problem is that the Israeli center, there's very little that distinguishes their national security policies from the policies of a Netanyahu government. The only chance we have is if Israel is confronted with a fait accompli of their impending defeat, and that there's a strategic recognition that if Israel continues down the same path, that it will lead to their demise. And that suddenly you can have, a former military officer who has the credibility of having fought in favor of the current policies, who says that these policies don't work anymore. You see, now he has credibility. He can say, I implemented these policies. I was out there fighting, and I can tell you these won't work, that Israel will be harmed if we continue to pursue these policies. We have no choice but to pursue peace. He can have the credibility. Yitzhak Rabin had that kind of credibility. So there's the potential for Israel to get a leader that moved, but it will not be easy because The Israeli nation has allowed Zionism to be codified in its DNA. And, one of the big problems that will be confronting any future leader isn't just dealing with Hamas, dealing with Hezbollah, but resolving the West Bank settlement situation, the crisis, dismantling the settlements, evicting the settlers from this land they have stolen, to redefine the green line and the territories encompassed by the green line so that they are more reflective of a viable Palestinian state than what they are today, which no Palestinian state could exist in the territories that are currently encompassed. So I don't think you're going to see that that kind of transition take place overnight. I think the first step is to get rid of Netanyahu. The second step is to have a series of failed governments led by people who are unwilling to make the changes necessary for Israel to survive in a world that recognizes the absolute need for a Palestinian state.
This Israeli lobby in the United States, in your opinion, are they considering some changes in their type of mindset toward Israel because of what's going on right now in Israel, because of these policies that you were talking about? And or they gonna support whoever gonna be in power in Israel and whatever they're doing in Gaza, in Israel?
There's two mindsets here. One is the, this lobby we speak of here in the United States. We agree that it's pro-Israel. But the question is it an Israeli lobby seeking to influence America to the in a way that best serves Israeli interests? Or is it an American lobby using Israel as a vehicle to further empower them in the United States? Because if you have the Israeli issue, you start controlling defense budgets, economic budgets, and things of that nature, you empower yourself even more. So where's the center of gravity? Is the center of gravity of the pro-Israeli lobby in Israel, or is it in the United States? Or is it a mix of the two? And I think it's a mix of the two, that you move between the two, because there's definitely an aspect of the pro-Israeli lobby that's about empowerment of America, self-empowerment within the framework of American governance. And therefore, it's in their interest to ensure that they don't become isolated from the American electorate. That, like any surviving parasite, you take a look at the host and you have to adapt to the host if you're going to survive. You have to make certain adaptations. And so this pro-Israeli lobby, the American aspect of it, is a parasite that's seeking to adapt to ensure its continued viability in a transforming American body politic. Meanwhile, in Israel, you have the pro-Israeli lobby that's linked to what's best for Israel, and right now that's defined by a very extreme definition of what Zionism is and what Israel is and what a Palestinian state will never be. They are, again, they're a parasite, and they will have to adapt to certain realities, Israeli realities. And so you have this thing we call the pro-Israeli lobby that actually has two competing centers of gravity that are adapting to two different realities, because a domestic Israeli political reality may be different than a domestic American political reality. And so they have to then find a way, because once they break off and become separate and a wall is built between them, that's the end of it. Because this group can't survive without that group, and that group can't survive without this group. And so they have to make sure that there's never a break, never a divide, that they're always together. So it's sort of this triangulation of adaptability. And it's a very complicated thing right now. I think that, like all parasitic entities, they seek to survive. They will adapt as necessary to continue to survive. And survival isn't linked to a specific ideological mindset. Survival is linked to survival. And so they will adapt as the situation arises, based upon reality. But they will never adapt in a way they always have to be. They're always, they exist because of the tensions that exist. If you create an environment where there's no tension, then there's really no need for a pro-Israeli lobby anymore, is there? The pro-Israeli lobby exists because of tensions that they have to come in and exploit to make themselves relevant. And so these parasites are very complex. They have to promote tension, but maintain enough flexibility to adapt to changing environments to guarantee their continued survival. Right now, I think that the most important part of this is the pro-American aspect of it, because the American dynamic is changing. We see Joe Biden felt comfortable enough to deny Israel weapons. No American president wins election by denying Israel weapons, but he did it because of domestic political realities. We see increasing support for the Palestinian cause, with students on campus, and schools are starting. We have graduation, so the support's probably going to migrate to the American streets, and we might have a long, hot summer of anti-Israeli demonstrations. The pro-Israeli lobby has to adapt to that because they have to be careful. If they get too far out of whack with the political scene, come election day, they might find themselves to be totally made politically irrelevant. They are only they are only relevant as long as there's politicians that deem the support of this lobby to be necessary for their continued survival as politicians. But when the politicians wake up and check the political lens, that they say that the pro-Israeli lobby is an anchor holding me down, that if I'm going to get reelected, because that's the most important thing in the world, is to get reelected, I need the support of the Palestinians. The lobby now is dies. So I think there's a lot of activity in the United States right now to make the Israeli lobby as relevant as possible in the coming election.
Do you think that the presence of nuclear bombs in Israel would be problematic for future, for the peace?
The history of Israel's nuclear weapons program is such that it balances the need to have a nuclear deterrence to guarantee their survival, and the need to maintain American support. If you study, if you read, the period of time in the early 1960s through the late 1960s into early 1970s, as the debates are taking place, especially in the, I mean, it started with Kennedy, but it goes on through Johnson, but in Nixon, where the Nixon White House is talking to the Israeli government about its nuclear program, and the notion of deniability, plausible deniability, comes into play. Israel was never allowed to publicly announce its nuclear weapons, and if you see how that decision making was done, so that the United States, was saying, "Well, we know you have nuclear weapons, but we can't act on that if you don't acknowledge you have nuclear weapons. So as long as you acknowledge, don't acknowledge it, you don't have to deny it, just don't acknowledge it. We will pretend that you don't have them from a policy standpoint." The Israelis have even gone as far as, when they talk about how they go about the path taken to acknowledge the existence of nuclear weapons. It's not just use them. There's a whole sequence of events that Israel has talked about, how they declare the weapon, then they test the weapon, then they demonstrate the weapon, then they use the weapon. There's this whole thing, but from the American perspective, the second they declare the weapon, we have to react, or we should react. We're in a situation today where Israel has almost declared that they have the weapon. I mean, they've had a number of politicians who have declared it, but then had to walk it back because they were told you're not allowed to declare it. But right now Israel is threatening Iran with certain weapons capabilities that has caused Iran. There was a statement made by the by a spokesperson of the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, to a official state press organ, the student press, that said Iran is reconsidering its stance on nuclear weapons. It's a big deal. Why would Iran do that? Because they feel as though Israel has made a direct threat to use nuclear weapons against them. So this is, it's a very dangerous situation. I think at some point in time, if we're going to prevent Iran from feeling the need to develop nuclear weapons and therefore hopefully prevent a nuclear war between Iran and Israel, we are going to have to, the international community is going to have to find a way to get Israel to put its nuclear weapons on the table. We have to get rid of them just like we had to get rid of South Africa's nuclear weapons. They are a destabilizing element in terms of the threat they pose to international peace and security.
It's not just Iran. We know Turkey was talking about these nuclear bombs. If Turkey is not feeling safe with Israel having these nuclear bombs, on the other hand, if Iran gets nuclear bombs, we have Saudi Arabia one.
Well,
It's a game of
this
it's
is the
an
danger.
endless game.
It's the danger. And from an American perspective, and from a Russian perspective, and the Chinese perspective, this is why we have to start talking about putting Israel's nuclear weapons on the table, because the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons, and the fact that Israel has felt a need to transition away from purely a deterrence policy, where plausible deniability can exist, to a war-fighting policy where it actively integrates its nuclear weapons into a war-fighting concept. There is no plausible deniability there. So right now, Israel is in the gray zone between this. Now the pressures on Iran, on Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Turkey, and others to get nuclear weapons is real. And this is the exact opposite trajectory that we should want to be going on as a global community. And so the solution is to start engaging with Israel. And I think now's the time because, frankly speaking, Israel is going to have to re-examine how it interfaces with the region and the world. It's going to have to accept a Palestinian state. And as Israel starts to make the compromises necessary to exist in such a scenario, now's the time to talk, to put nuclear weapons on the table. Now's the time to start talking about the disarmament of Israel.
Xi, in his recent visit to Europe, said that they defend two-state solution in Palestine and Israel. And when we can have Europeans talking about this in a direct manner and so solid manner, in your opinion?
When in Europe declares independence from the United States, until then, Europe is just an extension of American national security and foreign policy, and Europe has no independent voice. So, if Europe wants to be taken seriously, then it needs to become independent. That means it probably needs to get out of NATO, because as long as Europe's wrapped up in NATO, they're wrapped up in American policy prerogatives.
But how about this new trip, this new visit of Xi to Europe? Are we going to have some sort of game of pushing and pulling between China and the United States in Europe?
No, Europe doesn't matter. Europe's an irrelevancy. China is going there to, let Europe know that they'd like to continue to do business. But if Europe wants to play stupid games, then China is fully capable of terminating its economic relationship with Europe. China was in the driver's seat. There's no push and pull game. What influence does the United States have on China? Janet Yellen went, Tony Blinken went, they met a solid wall. You can only engage in a tug of war if you put a rope down on the ground and you say, "Scott, I challenge you to a tug of war." And I go, "Nah." And I just keep walking, doing my thing, having meetings and making money. And you're sitting there on the field with looking at the rope going, "Why isn't he engaging in a tug of war with me?" Because you're irrelevant. You don't matter. So the United States and Europe are putting ropes on the ground saying, "Let's get in the tug of war." And China's going, "That's all right. You two can play that game. We're in the dominate the world game, economically. We'd like to talk to you. We'd like to work with you, but we don't care about you." And that's the point. The United States and Europe become irrelevant. Earlier we had a talk about how Europe was aligning with the United States about anti-Taiwan policy. Okay, so you're China and you know that's happening. And now what, you want to come to Europe and pretend that everything's okay? Everything's not okay. It's not good. And so, China's just not going to allow itself to be dragged down in stupid European games. That's my opinion.
Just to wrap up this session, how about the role, how do you see the role of India? We haven't seen anything from India so far. This is a big country. This is a very influential and so important country, but we haven't seen anything from their policy. Just yesterday, I've learned that we've seen in the news that India was helping Israel to attack Rafah. I don't know if how much of the reality is in this news, but overall, when you look at India, how do you see its role in the current situation, in this complexity that we're witnessing right now?
India is a nation that believes that it deserves a place at the head of the table. It deserves a membership in the Security Council of the United Nations, that its voice should resonate in BRICS and in the G7. And therein lies the problem. BRICS and the G7 are on two totally opposite trajectories. They're not complementary organizations. BRICS exists because of the policy failures of the G7, the fact that the developing South, the global South, doesn't see eye to eye with the agendas pushed by BRICS or by the G7, by extension, the G20, which of course only exists because the G7 created it. BRICS is the counterbalance to that. So India was more than happy to join BRICS, but India very much wants to be a member of the G7. They'd like it to become the G8. This means that India is on the fence trying to serve two masters, and you can't serve two masters. India is rapidly becoming irrelevant. It needs to make a decision. And the problem for India is that the immediate attraction is with the West, but the West is a sinking ship. There's no level of Indian membership is going to revive the G8. India doesn't have the ability to be a global economic changer like China is. India doesn't have the ability to do a Belt and Roads Initiative competition. When the Indians do talk about this, they speak in terms of the India-Middle East Economic Corridor that they all say is so important. But we've talked about this before. When you start at the beginning in Mumbai and you finish in Greece, 80% of what's in the middle is linked to Chinese Belts and Roads. So India can't do anything without China already to begin with. India is very nervous about China's dominance position in BRICS. If they join BRICS and jump into BRICS, they're concerned that China will wrap them up and get more influence than India is comfortable with. But if India goes to the West, they have to understand that the West doesn't respect India at all. The West, India considers itself to be a sovereign state, but how can you be sovereign when the West sanctions you and threatens sanctions every time you try to do something? When was the last time the United States threatened to sanction Great Britain? I mean, the G7 doesn't sanction the G7. But India wants to join the G7, but the United States and others are threatening sanctions. India will never join the G7. India is a nation that is nullified itself because it can't make a decision. Do I stay with the West? Do I go to the East? What do I do? They can't make up their minds, so they're stuck in the middle. And as a result, decisions are being made in BRICS about expansion that India is, opting out of. Decisions are being made in the G7 about, containing Russia and China that re would require India to, participate in sanctions, but India can't do that because of the interconnectivity. India needs to make a decision. And frankly speaking, there's only one decision they can make, and that's to join BRICS and be a full member of BRICS. But the current Indian government's not in a position to do that.